Mics are live.
Good morning, everybody. It is 10:06 a.m. Wednesday, March 18th, 2020. I'm Commissioner Brian Crashus, joined by Commissioner Julie Fedorchek and Commissioner Randy Christman. So we do have a quorum. In terms of opening comments, I'm going to be somewhat of a broad overview, but have had some questions about our interaction with our utilities and contingency plans they may be putting in place or actually are putting in place related to potential employees that may not be able to go to work due to illness or quarantine measures if it should get to that point. And I would just emphasize that they've all been incredibly cooperative as a part of this process, and that we are actively, again, communicating back and forth with them, getting regular updates in terms of what their plans are. And it's a very proactive approach, and which I do appreciate. And I think I can say with a very high level of confidence, I don't anticipate any problems due to the proactive planning measures that they're putting in place and have already begun to implement. And we've done similar things here at the Commission as well in terms of looking at telecommuting as a primary option if needed, and just getting prepared that way in the event it becomes a requirement. And hopefully not, but if it does, we'll be more than ready to accomplish the work that needs to be done. And there are just so many different people and agencies, from the governor's office to the Department of Emergency Services. I had a call last night. And I think we've all been getting calls from different entities as well, and communicating with them accordingly. And I really like what I did hear from one. And it's it's about planning. It's not about panicking, because it's we'll move through it. We'll get through it. And I think there are a lot of questions right now, but there are also a number of rumors that aren't founded with any real data or facts out there. And we just want to be careful of that, that we continue to exercise good North Dakota common sense as we move through the days ahead. And at some point we'll be looking back and there'll be some lessons learned. But I think everyone's doing just an excellent job to date and expect that to continue. Commissioner Fedorchek.
Thanks, Brian. I just echo your thoughts and want to thank Steve in particular, and Jack and Jill, who have been working hard on our staff and our IT folks. And I'm really comfortable that we have a good plan in place for working from home and supporting the governor's recommendations as he rolls them out, and being, team players. I think that's what is required of all of this, is to just trust the people who are looking at the data and looking at the recommendations from the, scientists and the disease experts, and just following along and doing our part. And I think that we have a good plan in place to do that. And it's also a good opportunity to test our work from home procedures and get all that equipment in place, which, again, you never know when a disaster might pop up that requires all of that. So it's really, really good to have people familiar with how to make that happen. So I applaud that. And there is an agenda item on for admin discussion to talk in a little bit more detail about some communication I think we want to enhance with the utilities on some of their contingency planning for their control rooms and generation services, et cetera, et cetera. I think all those things are in place. I don't have concerns about them. I just want to make sure that we're getting that information from them, as well as some of the other stuff they've already provided. So
yeah, and I'll share conversations I've had with the different CEOs and spokespeople.
Okay.
So I'll update during admin. So Commissioner Christman?
Don't want to just reiterate the same things. You've pretty well covered it, except for one thing. And I think this virus crisis can, it's unpredictable how big of a crisis it turns out to be for our state and nation. but I think one of the things that everyone needs to try to do is recognize that we're all not in all of the meetings that other people are in, And whether it's this agency working with utilities or whether it's state leadership, from the governor's office and his various agencies or federal agencies, I think sometimes when something seems to not be done correctly or being overdone or something like that, we need to step back and realize they may have a lot of information that we don't have too, and just try and be patient with proposals that might not be to our liking at all times, but recognizing that different people have different information for various situations, and we need to respect that in this time.
All right. Thank you, Randy. Commissioner Chrisman, to be more formal, right? So
either's fine.
Thank you and thank you. Okay, so moving into the regular agenda, my first item, I move the commission adopt the order and notice on default in Public Service Commission Dakota Services, Muriel Close, Damage Prevention Enforcement, case number PU-19-113.
Second.
On April 1st of 2019, the commission received a North Dakota One Call complaint from the city of Arnegard, North Dakota, alleging a violation by Dakota Services of the One Call Excavation Notice System, otherwise known as One Call Law. On April 4th, the commission of 2019, the commission sent a letter to Dakota Services enclosing the One Call complaint, and Dakota Services filed a response on June 18th, 2019, to the One Call complaint. And then on September 19th, commission advocacy staff filed a formal complaint alleging Dakota Services violated North Dakota Century Code Section 49-23-04 by failing to contact the notification center and provide an excavation or location notice before beginning any excavation. The commission found that the formal complaint stated a prima facie case, and then on October 24th, 2019, the commission served the formal complaint on Dakota Services. We did receive evidence in terms of a return receipt that was filed received by the commission on January 2nd, but in between that period, at the beginning of November, I believe it was, we hadn't received a response, so then it was actually hand-delivered, the complaint was by the sheriff. Which I'm going to talk a little bit just about the procedure after pointing out a few more things. The facts before the commission indicate that Dakota Services is in default for failing to answer, to file an answer within 20 days after service of the formal complaint. Therefore, in terms of the order, Dakota Services is in default under North Dakota Century Code Chapter 28-32 and North Dakota Administrative Code Chapter 69-02-02 for failing to file an answer to the formal complaint within 20 days after service of the formal complaint. Dakota Services also is found to be in violation of North Dakota Century Code Chapter Section 49-23-04, which is the one-call law, by failing to contact the notification center and provide an excavation or location notice before beginning excavation. As a result of that violation, Dakota Services is assessed a civil penalty of $500. And I just want to note that that civil penalty of $500 is tied to the one-call infraction. They have 10 business days upon approval of this order, under the assumption that it is approved, to submit the $500 to the Public Service Commission. Dakota Services also, as a part of this, they do have 7 days after service of this order and notice on default to file a written motion requesting that the default order be vacated if they so choose. But I think, in my opinion, this is straightforward in terms of the process that is followed on all complaints was put in motion after receiving the complaint from the city of Arnegard. So it was consistent in terms of how it was handled with other cases. Staff works with potential violations and those entities at length. They make every effort to come to a resolution on these things without having to step things up along the way. If we do get to a point, which was the case, where we're not getting adequate response, then we will send, and in this case it was then became a formal complaint by staff, then we'll go through the certified mail process. Hopefully we get response from that. But that wasn't the case in this particular instance. But I just want to emphasize that staff makes every effort to work with companies when they are in violation, or if there is questions, are questions about a potential violation, they work very hard to try and remedy this and come to a reasonable resolution. And I believe they did in this case. So just a little more background, because we have a lot of damage prevention enforcement cases that come before the commission, and it's not as frequent in terms of including a notice of default. Which we did in this instance and finding of default.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion?
I have just one question, Commissioner Crosius, and that is, you mentioned that the $500 civil penalty is for the actual failure to get the one call note, you know, call one call and have the underground facilities flagged. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So is there no, do we not include penalties for being in default?
I don't believe we attach penalties for companies that are in default of a formal complaint in terms of receiving the notice.
Okay.
And acknowledging the notice. So
have we, Jack, do you want to set up? Have we had a previous example of not having any sort of a penalty for being in default?
Yes, we have general guidelines for penalties. Being in default is not something this in our guidelines that we consider. It could be how they react to some sort of how they respond to staff as well as the commission can be taken into consideration. But generally, when it comes to a default, we've just gone forward with the penalty that's recommended.
Okay.
This is, as I understand it, a smaller operation, and sometimes I don't know that they fully understand the gravity of when you get a complaint, if they're not contesting and they think, well, I'm just going to ignore it, it will run the course it's going to run. I don't know if they fully understand that they then wind up in default.
And do you know if we had any luck in reaching them, calling them?
Mm-hmm. There was communication early on, but there were a variety of reasons that a resolution was not, you know, it did not come to a resolution for a variety of reasons that just possible. I would phrase it, if I phrase this correctly, I'm just being a little careful in how I phrase it. They weren't options and alternatives that the commission could consider that the complainant was offering as a resolution to the issue.
But so they certainly knew that they were required to respond and didn't.
Mm-hmm. I would believe so. The attempts were made to reach some type of a consent agreement, which is always the first option, but it just didn't occur. In this case, Jack gave me quite a bit of background on the calls.
If for this, they pay it and it's over, or what mm-hmm. What are the options now?
Yes, this is essentially an order of default, is saying you've had the opportunity to respond, you didn't respond, and therefore everything is just essentially taken as true.
Okay.
And this is, the case is essentially ordered.
I see. So we're basically assuming you had your chance to respond, you didn't, so we thereby assume that what we're alleging is
right.
True. And so here's your fine.
Right.
Or
okay.
as mentioned at the end, they do have 7 days after service of the order to file a written motion requesting that the default order be vacated.
Okay.
So they have that option. I'm not going to speculate on what they will or won't do, but they have that option.
Yeah.
Otherwise,
okay, I'm good. Thank you.
They have to pay the fine.
Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed signify by saying nay. The motion is approved. Commissioner or Chairman Crosius, would you like to go back and pick up the consent agenda?
The minutes.
Minutes.
We didn't approve the minutes.
We did not approve the minutes?
Nope.
All right, we can do that now. Would you like to do it now?
Please.
I move that we approve the previous minutes.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion is approved.
Okay, tough crowd this morning. And I think it's going to get even better. Actually, I'd be disappointed if it didn't. Okay, the next item on the agenda, the regular agenda, I move the commission adopt the order submitting rules to Attorney General for an opinion as to legality in Public Service Commission solar decommissioning rulemaking, case number PU-19-122, Public Service Commission pipeline safety rulemaking, case number GS-19-217, Public Service Commission energy conversion facility siting criteria rulemaking, case number PU-19-290, and Public Service Commission wind decommissioning rulemaking, case number PU-19-291.
Second.
Okay. This is arguably the longest order I think I've waded through in the past, so bear with me. On August 6, 2019, the North Dakota Public Service Commission issued a formal notice of intent to amend administrative rules and notice of public hearing and abbreviated notice of intent to amend administrative rules and notice of public hearing, proposing to create a new chapter, 69-09-10, proposing to amend section 69-09-03-02, amend section 69-06-08-01, and amend chapter 69-09-09 of the North Dakota Administrative Code. On August 6th and August 9th, staff filed statements regarding the required regulatory analysis, small entity analysis, and takings assessment. On August 7th, 2019, the Commission forwarded the notices to the Legislative Council for publication at least 30 days in advance of the hearing that did show up in 52 official county newspapers across the state the third week of August. On September 19th, 2019, the Commission held the public hearing as noticed here at the state capitol, and as a part of that allowed a comment period until September 30th, 2019, during which the Commission received and considered data, views, or written or oral arguments concerning the proposed rulemaking as a part of the rulemaking record. This involves, again, case number PU-19-122, which is a proposed new chapter for solar facility decommissioning, and consistent and in the same fashion that we have wind facility decommissioning. This chapter would now create solar facility decommissioning as well. In case number GS-19-217, that would be adopting the proposed amendments to section 69-09-03-02, which is essentially pipeline safety. We adopt federal pipeline safety regulations. When they make changes, we adopt those changes because we follow suit with that in terms of our pipeline safety regulations that we implement here. On case number PU-19-290, that's energy conversion facility siting criteria. The purpose of those amendments are to address concerns related to the impact of energy conversion facilities on military and Department of Defense operations. And then finally, on case number PU-19-291, that's the chapter 69-09-09, wind facility decommissioning. The purpose of those amendments are to clarify that decommissioning and financial assurance requirements apply to all wind facilities generating more than 500 kilowatts that have not been granted a waiver by the commission. So on the solar facility, we did receive written comments from a number of entities. On that particular one, on the pipeline, we did not receive any comments, and typically we don't on the pipeline safety regulations. We also received a number of comments, including from the Department of Defense, Regional Environmental Coordinator, and Colonel Todd Sowles, Director of Operations for the 20th Air Force, and that was related to PU-19-290, and again, relating back to military installations, as well as a number of industry groups and entities. And we also did receive written comments from the Office of Assistant Secretary of Defense as a part of that as well. So I'm going to just in layman's terms what some of these changes mean. And I want to actually, and I should have started with this, want to thank Jack, our attorney, John Hsu, otherwise known as Jack here at the office, for the time that he spent on helping to create and craft these, because it's a very, very lengthy process. It's a very detailed process, and you have to get it right. And he just did a wonderful job as a part of that entire process. So thank you for that. Now, whenever someone coughs,
I know. You feel like, it's just allergies. It's just allergies.
Mm-hmm. Allergies and a lot of talking. So, okay, on the decommissioning rules package, I'm going to just make some comments on that. And I know my colleagues will, or I anticipate that they will make comments as well. On the decommissioning rules, I look at the rules package as we currently have it in place, and not only wind, but also now for solar, as a working document that will be modified and will make changes to over the course of time. I don't think there's any question that that will happen. We're in the very early phase of the decommissioning part of any energy conversion facility because essentially it's very new to the commission, and it's new to commissions across the country. I've noticed in going through some dockets in Minnesota for some related facilities that we'll be working with that they have decommissioning plans that go back to 2006. But they weren't formal in nature. They weren't required by the legislature in Minnesota. But they're actually extremely close and almost in many ways identical to the rules we're putting in place. So this has been around for quite a while, but to formally put something in place, I think, is just a very smart thing for us to do. And on solar in particular, decommissioning is important because when you think about solar, 7 to 8 acres per megawatt. So a 5-megawatt facility, not a large generating facility, still might occupy 40 acres. And then as you get into the larger solar farms, they occupy considerable tracts of land. So we want to make sure that when these facilities are no longer in use, that they're properly decommissioned and the land is restored to its original state. One notable part of the rules package, which I greatly appreciate, is giving landowners flexibility in terms of what they want, would like to have stay, whether it's perimeter fencing, whether it's an outbuilding. So it doesn't all have to come down if the landowner wants even an access road to remain or topography changes to remain in place as well. That's up to the landowner as it should be. That's their right to do what they want with their land. So giving them that type of flexibility, I think, is smart. And ultimately, I think, similar to wind, the solar package creates a good balance between sound environmental stewardship and landowner rights. On the challenges for decommissioning and things that I think we'll see going forward, I think we'll continue to refine cost estimates that are coming in. I think, frankly, some are just simply too low right now. And I don't believe that they can be decommissioned for some of the estimate, you know, based on some of the estimates coming in. But I also understand that there's a cost associated with having to have bonds in place. But we also want to make sure we have enough cash at the end of the day to get this done. But really, the waste material, I think, is the big unanswered question in terms of what do you do with the large amount of fiberglass waste, for example, from the blades. As more of that, more blades are replaced, what do you do with the the fiberglass, because right now it's treated as solid waste. It's not in our jurisdiction. That's Department of Environmental Quality, their waste management division, but it's still a concern, I think, for North Dakota citizens, and I think that question has to be answered. Solar poses an equally, if not greater, challenge in terms of what do you do with panels, and this is looking down the road at 2, 3, 4 decades from now. But what do you do with the toxic waste that is associated with the solar panels? And that has to be answered as well. And currently, it's a question across the entire U.S. There are just a significant amount of waste. But just my thoughts on that. And then on the and there's so many different aspects to these rules. But on the military consideration. That was to expand or to expand the 1,200 foot setback rule for communication centers and to ensure that the military, in effect, can do its job when it needs to on an ongoing basis and communicate effectively without microwave interference that wind turbines, in particular, can cause. So. It basically carves out a 60-foot corridor, which was in place, but it better defined that corridor as well. So I think it helps to effectively address military concerns, and I think we arrived at a good place related to that. And I think, because I know there's more to cover, but related to decibel levels and some other components, but for now, I'll just yield and turn it over. Commissioner Fedorchuk, do you have some
I have just
comments?
A couple of comments, and one of those is on the sound levels of the wind, the wind decibel. This rule proposes changing them from 50 decibels to 45, 100 feet from occupied residences. And there was a fair amount of comment from the industry on this proposal. But they did acknowledge that, I mean, some of the comments were, there's no proof that this improves, that the sound has any health or a welfare impact to the people in the areas. But the reality is noise is one of the complaints of wind, and it is a complaint that we get. It's a complaint that local people get about wind farms. And this decibel level, 45, is commonly used throughout the country. So this rule change kind of brings us more in alignment with how this industry is treated in other states. And the industry acknowledged that in their comments, and they also said that it should not affect development. So this seems like a smart way to do that, to, you know, reduce the impact of wind development while also maintaining the viability of that industry long-term in our state. And interestingly enough, the Landowners Association, Northwest Landowners Association, did comment in support of this measure, and they said that they view it as being a step that can help preserve the rural lifestyle and potentially reduce the conflict between landowners and developers. And so that's I think a nice balance to be achieved through this change, and I look forward to implementing this in the future, assuming this goes through the next steps of the process and is finally approved. And then in terms of the solar decommissioning, I want to shout out to Commissioner Christmas for leading the efforts in that and putting us kind of on the forefront of the nation in establishing decommissioning standards for solar and renewable energy facilities. It's really, I think we've got very strong plans in place and requirements for doing that. So thank you for your leadership on that. And I, too, really appreciate in the decommissioning the inclusion of a waiver for landowners who might want to waive some of the requirements for the specific decommissioning outlined in the rules, but those waivers would have to be approved by this commission or any future commission. So it isn't as if the landowners themselves can unilaterally decide we're not going to go along with this. It has to be something that the commission approves with and believes is in the best interest long term for the state and the community and the area that there is in consideration. So I think it's a good overall package covering a lot of different issues, and I really appreciate working forward on this, Jack, and your effort to stay on top of the rules and continually make sure that we're always looking at the rules and making sure they're as effective as possible.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion?
I will just add, as far as that, the commission approval of the landowner requests, it is important because we don't want to develop a situation where, and I'll use, this is primarily about solar, but the wind is a good example. The wind turbine rights tend to pay pretty good. We don't want to develop a situation where the developers have an incentive to go out and let the people know if you don't sign the waiver on eliminating roads and all the decommissioning things, we'll just build on your neighbor's land, not yours, and kind of, in a way, almost force their hand. So it needs to be for some kind of a decent reason other than just to let the company slip away. I do want to say, though, on the solar decommissioning, as Commissioner Fedorchuk mentioned when I came in here, one of my primary goals was the wind decommissioning plans. And it's more than just writing a set of rules or a set of laws that they have to do this, because we've all seen industry of all kinds, not just electric even, but all kinds of industries, when they're shutting down and don't want to clean up, you spin that off into another corporation and let that go bankrupt and walk away. And so it takes more than just a set of decommissioning rules or laws. It takes some kind of financial assurance, as we saw that with the mining industry, many decades ago. So I think, very successfully established that with wind, and then solar has started to develop, and we've approved one large-scale commercial solar farm in North Dakota that hasn't been built yet, but it's been approved by this body. In that hearing, one of the things that was discussed was, with wind, we allow the turbine foundations to be left at a level 4 feet below the surface. And should all these mini pillars and anchors be removed or just cut off 4 feet down? One of the things in the discussion was that it might do a lot of damage to pull them out. I don't know that we have good evidence of that at this point, but I do always recall that one of the landowners that was at that hearing that was very supportive of the project, very supportive, on that point of discussion, said that he just assumes that we're going to make them pull them out. And so there is that assumption that we have a decommissioning plan that is workable. Now, I use that as an example. This still only requires it to 4 feet. I imagine that is something that will be addressed. Well, I intend to at least seek more information to see whether it really is that destructive to pull them out or not, or if there are other variables. But I think we're off to a tremendous start here, and it's more than a plan. It requires financial assurances, and that is really a key point. very well written here. I think that this order, our legal counsel has done a good job of responding to all the objections and concerns that were raised in the hearing process. So the Attorney General and the Legislative Committee should get a good description of how we've reached our conclusions.
I have one more thing. So in using a term from Scrabble last night, maybe, Randy, you should be the decommissioning czar. And then another thing I do want to point out, this rule package does not address the proposal that the Air Force came into during our hearing process and suggested the 2.1 nautical mile setback from any military installations or the nuclear missiles, underground nuclear missiles. That is not in this rule package. That was a proposal that they brought forward in the hearing process for this package. It was not a rule that we had proposed. And there is discussions ongoing between our staff, the industry, and the DOD and the Air Force, Minot Air Force Base, on that proposal. And I think that we'll be looking at down the road determining whether a rule is necessary for that. But those discussions are ongoing.
Is there any further discussion?
You know, just one or possibly two final points, because I hadn't flipped page two over, so I'll condense it of my notes. But I agree. The one thing that was very clear, and I think it's just a point to note as we went and or as we moved through the process and we had our working meetings, we really don't know what will be required to pull solar pedestals out. And I asked that question on a number of occasions. What does it really require? Is it going to do more damage than good by having complete removal? And I think for now, the 4-foot removal depth is appropriate until we get those answers. So I think that's very important. Just two other points. One is, it's important that we develop a rules package for decommissioning of any type of facility that is consistent across all industries. And I think that presents a challenge because each one has its own attributes and unique characteristics. But I think we also want to make sure that we're treating industry fairly and holding them all to the same high standards. So that will always be a work in progress, but something that we have to treat as a primary objective in this, and that is the element of fairness. And again, it's about not making things necessarily easier, but it's about applying the same high standard of accountability to each and every energy industry that operates in the state. And ultimately, the goal is we want to restore the North Dakota skyline and the prairie to its original state when these facilities are no longer in use. That is the end goal of all of this.
Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed signify by saying nay. The motion is approved.
Yeah. Thank you again, Jack. I know we are all incredibly appreciative, as you heard. So thank you for your good work. Okay, next on the agenda, I move the commission to adopt the order and Otter Tail Power Company Renewable Resource Cost Recovery 2020 rates, case number PU-19-387.
Second.
Okay, this would be the third leg of the stool, so to speak, because we did this for the other two utilities. Otter Tail actually pitched an idea very similar to this 12 to 13 years ago in terms of creating rate fairness when it came to wind facilities that they would have as a part of their generation fleet. So this is something that I think we have to recognize that Otter Tail in particular, you could argue, was ahead of their time in terms of where we're at today, but that was a different commission, different staff, and a different outlook on how to treat the production tax credits in particular, which is what this order addresses. This is a levelized cost method, and we had three options. One, to do nothing, to treat them, which isn't probably the best way of putting it, but to treat them as they had been treated in the past, which was when the company received the production tax credits. They were applied in that year and reflected in a customer's bill in that year. The problem with the production tax credit and the challenge is that after 10 years they expire and then the cost of the facility rises exponentially as quickly as those PTCs run out. And then there's a noticeable impact to the consumers. So it's important that we do something, and why we've been working on this. This is a little more pronounced in Otter Tail's case because they do operate a smaller system as compared to NSP. NSP has a generating fleet of approximately 10,000 megawatts. Otter Tail has 1,850. So the cost of the single facility attached to this renewable resource rider, which is the Mericourt Wind Facility, is not spread out to as many customers. So it is a more significant impact in terms of what it does on a customer's bill or what this would do to a customer's bill. And as a reminder, the Mericourt Wind Project, along with the Astoria gas plant in South Dakota, are to replace Hoot Lake in Fergus Falls, Minnesota. It's ending, nearing the end of its useful life. It will be retired, and Otter Tail is replacing it with a wind and gas generation mix of approximately 400 megawatts. And I'm trying to think if Hoot Lake was around 100 megawatts or maybe just a little bit more than that, but in that neighborhood. So more generating capacity, but since wind is a part of it as well, it that also decreases. But in terms of what this will do, and this dates back to a December 31st filing from Otter Tail Power of 2019, is change the revenue requirement, or how we apply that. The revenue requirement is just over $4 million. That would be April 2020 through March 2021. So it's actually going to change from a credit, a small percentage credit of negative 0.224%, to an increase of 4.11%. And in terms of what an average residential customer would experience, it would be a change of approximately $2.97 per month. And this would be in effect on April 1st, 2020, if approved. And just a little bit of history, this method was not adopted and approved for the other two, but I'm presenting it again, regardless, as a matter of consistency in terms of how I view this. I like this method. I think it creates the greatest element of fairness, and there are arguments both ways, I understand, but in this particular instance, I like we've been referring to it as the Victor Shook method, and then the other method as the levelized method. But make no mistake about it, they are both levelized methods. One is about levelizing the cost of the facility. The other is about levelizing the PTC value. But they are both levelized in nature. So I think it's easy to trip people up in terms of, well, one's levelized and one isn't. No, they're both levelized. And I do support this approach.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion?
Yeah, I prefer the other approach. So I would like to make a motion to see once how the votes come out to explore that. I'll explain the details and differences more if I get a second. So I would move the commission adopt the alternative order in Otter Tail Power Company Renewable Resource Cost Recovery 2020 rates case number PU-19-387.
Second.
So, you know, that term levelized, as Commissioner Krosh has discussed, you know, you can kind of evaluate that in different ways. The way I find it kind of confusing or deceiving, if people are just thinking of this for the first time and we're levelizing rates, that might make it sound like the goal is that the cost of paying for a facility, in this case it's a 25-year expected facility, would be the exact same every day and every month of every year. And that's not the way regulatory assets typically work. They, typically, you would have a declining amount. You pay more for something that's brand new than something that's on its last year of its useful life. And so, as Brian mentioned, there's the levelization of the PTCs and that. So when we talk here in this alternative of fully levelized, it does leave that declining revenue requirement, as would be the case if they were building a transmission line or something like that that had a long-term useful life. This alternative goes the step further. The other alternative that was just discussed does leave some additional costs out into the later years than what I think is the appropriate model that we use for other kinds of assets. And so, yes, the unfortunate thing is this does cost more in the upfront years. But I think we need to look at this from the perspective of the people that are still going to be paying on this or in 20 or 25 years. This will not be the end of asset development by this or any other company. And so when we get out 15, 20, 24 years, this needs to be at a lower amount because they're going to be adding new assets, and then those will be at the high end of their cost recovery. And so this is a tougher pill to swallow up front, but I do think it is the more appropriate in the long-term model for recovery of the costs of this asset. And by the way, so the recovery amount in the other alternative for the year was it $4.2 million, I think. This would bring it up to $5.7 million, and that average residential amount would go from $2.97 to $4.01.
We have a substitute motion and order. Is there any further discussion on the substitute?
I would say that I also support this approach. And again, really what we're doing here is discussing how to use the benefit of the production tax credits. In the past, the production tax credits have all been used on the front end. So they last for 10 years, but the projects are being paid for over 20 or 30 years. So currently, all the production tax credits were being used and the value of them were given to customers as they were realized. What we've done in the last couple of months is looked at, is that the right way? I mean, should we be using all of those values of the production tax credit to benefit today's customers when customers will be paying for this for twice as long as what the production tax credits are available for? And I think we all agree that, no, we shouldn't be doing that because when we approve these resources as being cost-effective for ratepayers, we looked at their overall costs, which factored in the production tax credits over the life of the facility, and reduced the costs accordingly. So we all agree that we shouldn't be using them all the production tax credits for the first 10 years. What Randy's alternative motion, which I agree, really uses them less on the front end to more mirror the way other generation assets are depreciated with utilities, so that today's customers pay more for the brand new facility, and the customers at the end of this facility's useful life will have a depleted asset that costs less. And so I think that it is more appropriate. It also shows customers more the true cost of what these new resources are in today's market. The production tax credit hid those costs more effectively and made them seem cheaper than they will be over the course of the life. And this also, regardless of which method you use, but more to the method that I'm supporting here, in year 10, when the production tax credits go away of any new facility, customers would, make no mistake about it, and it's very clear on all of the graphs, see a significant spike in the cost of those resources. So their rates would be going up then after 10 years have passed and they have a more depreciated asset. With the change in how we're doing this, that spike goes away. In the approach, this second approach, which is a fully levelized approach, that spike becomes much less. And in the more moderate approach, which is the first motion, that spike is a lot less than it would have been, but it's not as, you know, depreciated as it is under these. So I think this is the best approach. It does cost customers a little bit more on the front end, but I think that's appropriate in how these kinds of resources are typically charged to customers in other generation resources for utilities.
Is there any further discussion on the substitute motion and order?
Yeah, well, not surprising. I don't support this method in Otter Tail's case. For reasons as follows. First of all, you have to look at the geography that Otter Tail services. Otter Tail services towns like Milner, Foreman, Catherine, Lisbon, Abercrombie, places that have cafes, elevators in their towns that receive service from Otter Tail. Nowhere in the state have they been hit harder by the October snowstorm, flooding, late harvest, high propane prices, low commodity pricing that is all having a very distinct and a negative effect on their businesses on Main Street. And this was before the coronavirus, which has created even more financial uncertainty. And then you think about the low-income houses in these towns, and Otter Tail serves dozens and dozens of towns, small towns, you know, the bread and butter of North Dakota. They serve these towns. So we have low-income households. We have retirees who rely on Social Security and now their retirement plans for those that have them, those on fixed incomes, have been hit doubly hard. This just doesn't move to $4.01 from the $2.97. You have to look at 12 months from now. It's $7.34 per month. It's almost $100 per month. And with the financial uncertainty, that is a heavy load for a number of households. And we have a perfectly good mechanism in place that was driven, frankly, by feedback from things we had said throughout this entire process that a staff member put together. And it was a different type of levelization. But we have that discretion as a commission, and it's a very reasonable approach. In fact, it's an approach that Otter Tail themselves advocated for because they were afraid of sticker shock to their customers. And it does create rate fairness over the long haul over the next 25 years. It has the smallest variation from start to finish in comparison to the other levelized cost approach. So I just can't ignore what these communities have been going through, the fact that it's been compounded significantly just in the last several weeks alone, and that when you're approaching a $100 increase annually, when we could mitigate that to less than half of that amount, I think it would be better to recognize. And in fact, they're still harvesting corn in some of these areas. They're not even done yet. And now just isn't the time to layer one more burden, financial burden. And we do need to address it, and it does address it. It would still go into effect, but it would certainly mitigate the impact. And I know we don't know what the future will bring. I don't suspect that, I think I've heard estimates that by June or July, the coronavirus will have run its course. But I think there will be the distinct possibility that there's going to be long-term financial impacts. And it's going to take a while for markets to recover. And if you're still working, you have that luxury of waiting for markets to recover. If you're in retirement, you don't. So I just think it's too much of a ask right now. I think we have a choice we can make on going to a smaller amount that accomplishes the exact same objective in a fair and reasonable way. And I support making the change. I just don't support Fraud or Tail and their customer base. When you look at the geography they serve, I just don't support going this route when we had another method that I think would have been better.
Is there any further discussion on the substitute motion?
Yeah, I do want to add a couple things. First of all, either of these alternatives is a far fairer regulatory way of accounting for these costs than what has been done in the past and what's being done in most states, which, as Commissioner Fedorchak talked about, was basically pushing off costs and making full use of the PTCs in the first few years to make these assets seem real cheap. So either of these alternatives is a big improvement, as has been discussed, and I won't reiterate all the points. I think that the one on the table right now is the better of the two. I do want to address one more point, though. When it's said that we could mitigate some of these costs, let's not confuse what mitigate means, because we can't make them go away. All we can do is push them off onto someone some years down the road. And in the meantime, those dollars will continue to earn interest costs. And so it's whatever we don't pay up front will be paid for with interest later on. And so I think that this is the best of the two alternatives.
Is there any further discussion on the substitute motion and order?
So in other words, they cost more in the long run, the longer you put the costs off. So I think this, it's just, pay now or pay later, pay more later. And, nobody likes to increase rates for customers, but the reality is there's a huge amount of change occurring in the resource mix. There's a huge amount of investments being made by utilities in infrastructure, and those investments cost money, and we're looking for the fairest, most affordable way to recover those costs. And I agree with Commissioner Christman that this second option is the more fair way to do that.
Okay, well, just to be clear, since I am not going to vote in favor of this motion, that I do not disagree with changing the way that the PTCs have been accounted for and the impact to customer bills, and mitigate, just for reference, means to reduce. It's not eliminate. It's to reduce. That's what mitigate means. And there is a small difference in terms of the two methods in term. So it is true. It will cost slightly more, but I want to emphasize slightly more to go with a more balanced approach in terms of PTCs are recognized and the cost of the facility is taken into account. So I agree with doing something. We need to do something, but I just think it's too much of a jump to take when we have, again, what I think is a more reasonable option in front of us. So it's a disagreement or a difference of opinion, I should say. And I respect the position that my colleagues have. I just, from a practical standpoint, am voting no because I think the other option was more palatable to the people Otter Tail serves, as well as the businesses, which will actually see a significant, far more significant jump by applying this method at a time, again, when they're feeling it. And they're going to continue to feel the pinch, not only from ag, but now the slowdown in the economy on top of it. So that's why I'm going to vote no.
Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, I'll take a roll call vote on substituting the motion. Chairman Crosius.
No. Nay.
Commissioner Fedorchak?
Aye.
Commissioner Christman?
Aye.
The substitute motion is now on the floor. And I'll take a roll call vote on the substitute motion and order. Commissioner Crash or Chairman Crashes?
No.
Commissioner Fedorchak?
Yay.
Commissioner Christman?
Aye.
The motion is approved.
Okay, next on my agenda, I move the commission adopt the order and Public Service Commission, Montana Dakota Utilities Company, Pipeline Safety Enforcement, case number GS-20-015.
Second.
Okay, this is easier. So, on July 23rd, 2019, Public Service Commission staff conducted an operator qualification field inspection of Montana Dakota Utilities Company Gas Safety Program. On January 10th of 2020, the manager of the Public Service Commission Gas Pipeline Safety Program issued a notice of amendment. And again, I want to emphasize notice of amendment. On February 10th, MDU did supply and submit a response to the notice of amendment, and staff identified inadequacies in MDU's procedural manual for operations, maintenance, and emergencies related to the procedures being used by MDU's personnel in the field. The notice of amendment states that the standards did not contain adequate procedures, in other words, step-by-step instructions, with definitive language for personnel performing covered tasks. The covered tasks would include inspections and maintenance of regulator stations and inspections and maintenance of valves at regulator stations. As Title 49 Code of Federal Regulations, Part 192, states, procedural manual for operations, maintenance, and emergencies. Under that section, each operator shall prepare and follow for each pipeline a manual of written procedures for conducting operations and maintenance activities for the emergency response. These tasks that would be covered as a part of that are procedural in nature. They will more clearly identify the steps required to complete covered tasks by qualified individuals. And the respondent will be required, MDU will be required to replace suggestive wording with definitive wording in the procedures where applicable, just to clarify the obligation to complete specific actions while performing the procedures. MDU did not object to the proposed compliance and did not request a hearing, and they will have until March 30th of 2020, this month, to amend the written procedures as stated in the notice of amendment, compliance action, and provide to the commission documentation showing that the written procedures have been amended. So this was a good catch during the inspection process, and it will help tighten things up. So thank you for your work.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion?
I'll echo that. Caleb, thank you for looking at this stuff, and I think it's really helpful for the companies to know that these things are looked at, reviewed, and they matter. And I think it always is helpful to draw attention to this sort of stuff, and then the companies have to relook at it and go, oh, yeah, right, you're right. And it just kind of refreshes everybody. And sometimes in a regulatory environment, you can get a little complacent or things can feel a little stale. And so I think it's really important, especially in this area of gas pipeline safety, that that never happens and that we're always kind of on our toes, aware of the fact that this infrastructure that goes up to a lot of homes in North Dakota and businesses is, it can be a dangerous thing, and it needs to be properly maintained and examined and operated. And so I really appreciate you holding these companies accountable for high standards.
Caleb is still a relatively new staff member who has hit the ground running and is just doing a really, really solid job. So,
is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed signify by saying nay. The motion is approved.
Okay, final item for me. I move the commission adopt the order on electric service Area Agreement and Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity in Northern States Power, Nodak Electric Cooperative, Thompson, North Dakota Service Area Agreement, case number PU-20-37, and Northern States Power, Nodak Electric Cooperative, Thompson, North Dakota Public Convenience and Necessity, case number PU-20-41.
Second.
January 31st, 2020, NSP and Nodak Electric filed a joint application for approval of a service area agreement to establish service areas and designate service locations to be served by NSP and Nodak within and around the city of Thompson, North Dakota. NSP requested issuance of a public certificate of public convenience and necessity authorizing it to extend service to locations within the NSP service area set forth in the agreement. We did issue a notice of filing and notice of opportunity for consolidated hearing. We did not receive any responses. And the agreement is in place to, one, avoid misunderstanding and disagreement over areas to be served by each party, two, accomplish the legislative intent of North Dakota Section 49-03-06, which is to encourage harmony and operational efficiency among electric providers, promote safety, discourage unreasonable duplication of electric facilities, and to assure adequate and reliable electric service, as well as providing antitrust immunity to the electric providers. And that, three, provide both parties with equitable participation in the provision of electric distribution service in areas with and around the city of Thompson during the terms of the agreement. So this is an agreement, again, between the cooperative and NSP that they've put in place to serve Thompson and the area around Thompson. They're working together to both gain mutual efficiencies, and it does, in my opinion, avoid a duplication of service. It makes sense. And when they're working in partnership to serve a community, whether it's Thompson or any other North Dakota community, and they're on the same page, that's a good thing. So I appreciate their work that they both did together on this particular matter.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion?
Just a add a tiny bit more background. This is interesting because the original service agreement was developed in 1960, and so this is reestablishing the boundary lines because there's a new residential development in Thompson that would have been bisected by the old service agreement. So, again, to Commissioner Crosius's comments, kudos to NODAC and Xcel Energy for coming to an agreement on this, allowing the most cost-effective service to be established for that new residential addition to the community of Thompson, and great for Thompson that it's growing.
Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed signify by saying nay. The motion is approved.
Okay, and that completes my portfolio. I think I set a record for the amount of time.
Quite a while ago already.
So, I expect some kind of a plaque or something as a result of this. So I'd be disappointed if I don't.
I broke it last week, but you shattered mine.
Well, someone just had to supply a substitute motion. So that completes my portfolio, Commissioner Fedorchuk.
I just have one item. I move the commission deem complete the application for a certificate of site compatibility and contingent on filing with the commission at least 15 days prior to the hearing date, responses to the February 26, 2020 and February 27, 2020 request for information letters, and issue a notice of filing public hearing in OE2 North LLC B Sanderson Gas Processing Plant, Williams County Siting Application Case Number PU-20-082.
Second.
So a public hearing on this application is scheduled at 9 a.m. on April 24th at the City of Williston Public Works and Engineering Department in Williston. OE2 North LLC filed an application for this project. It's a 250 million standard cubic feet per day gas processing plant in Williams County. The facility is proposed to be located 15 miles west of Williston. It will process wellhead gas in Williams County. It's a $150 million project, and pending all approvals, et cetera, the permitting process, they anticipate being up and running by the end of this year. We did add, we're not 100% sure how our siting hearings will be taking place moving forward, but we know for certain we will, hopefully one way or another, have this portion of the public hearing in Williston on this date. If we need to have the more evidentiary hearing in another manner, by web or by interactive video, that will also be broadcast by and available to the public to listen to. That may be an alternative that we use to be able to proceed with these siting hearings while also still maintaining our requirement to have the public the opportunity for public comment. And so we may, right now we've got this hearing date and location scheduled. We're also allowing for additional time for written testimony up to 5 days after the hearing to accommodate members of the public that are unable to attend due to coronavirus concerns. So this does, we hope to be able to continue to work through the siting applications we've received, recognizing our short window of construction in North Dakota and the need for us to continue the permitting process in a deliberate way in these next couple months, despite some of these coronavirus concerns. We will be using technology and other means as best as possible to still accommodate the siting processes. So this is the first one that's going to fall under that category, and we might be altering some of the others that are on this schedule as well, using technology to continue to meet the needs of the public hearing while also getting the information we need to make our decisions. But this is the first new one that we are setting the date for under the current regime of coronavirus regulations. So that, I think that kind of concludes the description of this one.
A motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
I have one concern on this. And maybe it actually ends up being a benefit in the current situation with the virus. But this location, although when we were up there for a previous hearing at the Public Works Building, the people there could not have been more accommodating. I just don't find the facility itself to be very accommodating for a public hearing. The public needs to come in. They need to be buzzed in, and then a couple, two or three long hallway corridors, and then up a flight of stairs. I don't really find that accommodating in the community that large. We're not talking about, you know, a real small town in a real rural county. It seems like there must be a way to find a better location. Now, in this particular case, maybe it helps that we won't get casual people who are just curious and show up to listen in. You certainly need to want to be there participating to go through what it takes to get in there to attend. So maybe it's even a good thing, but I sure wouldn't object if we could find a different location either.
We'll take note of that, Randy, and see what can be done. I do think that at the very least, we need to get the notice up on the front door earlier so that people know where they're going in that facility. At the last hearing, it didn't seem to create any problems for folks. There were members of the public who did attend and found their way. And I think because the staff at this public works building is so accommodating and helpful, and there is an elevator also for public access, so the stairs aren't, shouldn't stop anyone who you can't do stairs from participating.
Yeah, I can see that.
So I think that, but I agree with you, and if we aren't able to change it for this one, I think just moving forward, staff should note that this isn't a location that we want to keep using. It's just, it's a little bit too cumbersome for folks from the public to attend, because you can't just walk right in. You have to be buzzed in.
And I can appreciate the fact that I believe it was driven by City Hall being remodeled, something to that extent.
Yeah.
So that wasn't available, and I don't know what else is in Williston. So I know it's challenging.
Well, there's hotels and stuff we certainly could check with and have used in the past. So that would be the other
option. How about the airport conference room?
Now, there creates a whole different set of barriers.
I just didn't realize how far out the airport is located from just getting into Williston itself. Very nice airport.
In a beautiful location.
Very beautiful.
Very scenic.
Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed signify by saying nay. The motion is approved.
I don't know if I said aye loud enough, but I was an aye, Steve. I think I had something caught in my throat. All right. Thank you, Commissioner Fedorchuk. Commissioner Chrisman.
I move the commission approve the decommissioning plan and cost estimate filed on November 1st, 2019, and the self-guarantee filed on February 28th, 2020 for the Cedar Hills Wind Facility and Montana Dakota Utilities Company, a division of MDU Resources Group Incorporated, Cedar Hills Wind Project, Bowman County, North Dakota, decommissioning plan and cost, case number PU-10-491.
Second.
The Cedar Hills facility consists of 13 GE 1.5 megawatt turbines with a total nameplate capacity of 19.5 megawatts. It doesn't hardly seem believable in this day and age of the wind farms we see nowadays of 200-300 megawatts, but it is 19.5. On November 1st of last year, MDU filed an updated decommissioning plan and cost estimate in the amount of approximately $3.4 million. Or an average of $259,000 per turbine. In June of this year, Cedar Hills will be operational for 10 years, and therefore MDU is required to file a form of financial assurance guaranteeing the decommissioning of the facility. MDU filed a self-guarantee for $3.4 million, as I said, which is the total amount to decommission. MDU meets the PSC's criteria to offer a self-guarantee. Staff has reviewed the plan, the cost estimate, and the self-guarantee and believes them to be reasonable and in compliance with commission rules, and I agree with that assessment.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
Earlier in the meeting, I had indicated that I felt some of the decommissioning plans weren't adequate in terms of cost estimate. I think this is a very good plan that they have in place. I think at $259,000 as compared to some that we've seen that are below $100,000 per turbine, that gives me a high level of confidence that they will have the necessary money in place to decommission when the time comes. So I appreciate the company's more aggressive approach and what I believe is more realistic approach to the numbers that they presented.
Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed signify by saying nay. Motion is approved.
Yeah, I move the commission suspend the amendments to the Quest Performance Assurance Plan and Performance Indicator definitions and issue a Notice of Opportunity for Hearing in Quest Corporation, PIDS and PAP, revision case number PU-20-087.
Second.
And I will explain the PAP and the PIDS here. Under the Federal Telecommunications Act of 1996, Quest Corporation, which is doing business as CenturyLink, is required to provide open access to its network, facilities, and services to other providers of telecommunications services, such as competitive local exchange carriers. The PIDs, the Performance Indicator Definitions, provide specific data about the quality of the open access provided by CenturyLink And the PAP, the Performance Assurance Plan, applies specific standards or goals that the performance measures must accomplish. CenturyLink filed an application with the Commission for approval of amendments to the PIDs and PAP. The proposed amendments were prompted by the FCC's 2019 forbearance orders, which eliminate the obligation to provide unbundled analog loops and avoided cost retail discounts to resellers. CenturyLink is requesting, effective May 1st of 2020 already, approval of the amendments and requesting that existing interconnection agreements be modified to incorporate these amendments without the need for further filings or approvals. The issues to be considered in this matter are whether the amended PIDs and PAP should be approved and whether all existing interconnection agreements with CenturyLink should be modified to incorporate applicable amendments without the need for further filings or approval. So the Commission has authority to approve or disapprove these changes. In this case, the comments and requests for hearings will be received by May 4th of 2020, and I understand that CenturyLink was hopeful of having these all approved a few days even before that, but it's just not going to move quite that quickly. If deemed appropriate, though, the Commission can determine the matter without a hearing after we get through that opportunity.
Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed signify by saying nay. The motion is approved.
I believe you guys turned down the opportunity to say PAP and PIDs.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner Christman. In terms of announcements, we do have an informal hearing today at 1:30 here in the Commission meeting room, hearing room. It's for Boomerang Wireless, LLC. It's a designated eligible carrier application. We also, on Monday, March 30th, have a formal hearing. That will be in Newtown, North Dakota, at Teddy's Residential Suites. That's for Whiting Oil and Gas Corporation, and that's the Robinson Lake Oil Conditioning, Montreal County, siting application. And then, finally, on April 1st, that will be our next regular commission meeting at 10 o'clock here in the commission hearing room. And at 1:30 that day as well, we have an informal hearing with One Oak Bakken Pipeline, or with One Oak on their Bakken, or actually it's One Oak Bakken Pipeline LLC. It's the pump station additions in McKenzie and Dunn counties. Again, 1:30 here in the commission hearing room. We'll now take a brief recess and questions from the press, followed by the administrative portion of the meeting. This meeting is now in recess.
Commissioner Cross.